Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Throughout U.S. history, battles have arisen between states' rights to self-govern and the power of national government to pass laws applying across the country. With the emergence of Donald Trump in the presidency, many cities and states are gearing up to resist his agenda. How will states' rights figure into the resistance? With us is Sanford Levinson, professor of law and government at the University of Texas, the author or co-author of 10 books, including Our Undemocratic Constitution, and the latest, Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Sandy Levinson. It's always great to have you on here. We have a new president with an agenda that conflicts with a lot of the state agendas and a lot of local government agendas. It's not the first time in American history that we have seen such a gulf between what the national government wants to do and what local governments want to do. So I thought perhaps we should do a little walk through history in the United States and talk about what some of those big ones were and what happened. I know the first one started with Thomas Jefferson.
I think what we're going to see is a revival of what I call neo-nullificationism. And if I can, I'd like to mention a book that the University of Kansas Press just published that I edited called Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought. And in my own essay introducing it, I suggest that what had thought to have been, you know, basically extinct ideas are, you know, rising from the grave. In fact, one person described it as a kind of zombie constitutionalism. But the fact is that there is ample precedent. And one of the things that's important in beginning with Thomas Jefferson, instead of, say, with John C. Calhoun, is that you realize that nullification, that is the attempt by states to insist that they're really not bound by federal law, doesn't begin with slavery, even though that's the best known instance of nullification, but rather it began with resistance to the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. And in fact, you also see nullificationist arguments made by several of the northern states in the 18 teens. And what I think you're going to see in the coming 4 years is what I call neo-nullificationist arguments made by a number of liberal states and localities. They're not going to say what Jefferson said, perhaps unwisely, which is that states can declare null and void what the national government does. That's a non-starter. There is no reason to believe that any federal court would accept the authority of states to declare federal law unconstitutional unless the courts themselves found the laws to be unconstitutional. But my friend Heather Gerken, who teaches at the Yale Law School, has co-authored with Jessica Bowman Posen at Columbia a really important article called Uncooperative Federalism. And what she points out is that a lot of federal programs depend, I should say a lot of national programs, depend on state or local level cooperation to implement them. And if states and localities are resistant, then they can go a long way to torpedoing these national programs. Furthermore, one of the other essays in the book that I mentioned by Ernie Young, who teaches at Duke, talks about Colorado's legalization of marijuana. Now, every lawyer knows that if the national government wishes to go after Colorado, the national government will win. That Colorado simply does not have the constitutional right to legalize marijuana against existing federal drug law. That being said, what happened after Colorado's referendum was that Eric Holder, who was then Attorney General, said, in effect, that the national government wouldn't enforce the federal drug law against Colorado so long as Colorado made sure to implement its own drug legalization program responsibly. That is, no selling of drugs to kids. So it's really a game of chicken. To what extent will the national government be willing to enforce federal laws in states that want to go their own ways and where there's wide public support? So if Jeff Sessions is confirmed as Attorney General, Sessions is on the record as hating marijuana and having no sympathy with state legalization programs. That being said, will he be willing, or will Donald Trump as president be willing, to pay the severe political costs of sending in the feds to shut down a now well-established $60 million a year industry in Colorado? So you're going to see a lot of those games of chicken being played, where states or cities will go their own way. They will declare themselves sanctuary states or sanctuary cities, as California has done, or as some cities have done, and they really will dare the national government to pay the political costs in enforcing what are undoubtedly legally valid national laws, but deeply, deeply unpopular in a number of states and localities. And we've seen that already over the last 8 years, but with the negatives flipped. So you've had conservative states like Texas dare the national government to enforce some environmental laws and to enforce other laws. And it really has been a game of sustained chicken. Some of the time the national government has really been vigorous in enforcing national law. Other times they step back. And I think you're going to see more and more of that over the next 4 years.
So in some of those instances where the more conservative states argued that they wanted to do things completely the opposite direction as the national government, have there been instances, very many of those instances, when the national government stepped in and said, my way or the highway?
Well, I mean, there have been lawsuits that have been filed. Some of them won by the national government, some of them on hold. They're still in litigation, in part, frankly, because a lot of it has depended on very, very strong readings of congressional statutes by the executive. So what we have had during the Obama administrations, and of course, this is one of the things that conservatives have lambasted Obama for doing, is to make very strong claims about executive power. Now, as a matter of fact, so did George Bush. So did Bill Clinton. That what we have seen really now for basically 20 years is a fundamental breakdown of governance at the national level, where Congress is unable to pass legislation in lots and lots of areas because of gridlock. So this has tempted presidents, both Democratic and Republican, to push executive power for all it's worth. So not surprisingly, the states have pushed back in litigation, and they have found some sympathetic conservative judges to uphold the claims of states against the executive. But as I say, what's coming up and what's so intriguing about this is going to be the reversed polarity, where it will be liberal states and liberal mayors who are going to be arguing that the Trump administration is overreaching. And it will be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, the Supreme Court has been controlled now for 20 years by conservative Republicans who have been busy talking about state sovereignty, the dignity of states, and the importance of recognizing state autonomy in a number of important areas. now, to some extent, the shoe may be on the other foot. And there will be a lot of conservatives who will be accusing liberals of being simply opportunistic in making, you know, state autonomy arguments. But then there will be lots of liberals who will be accusing conservatives of being equally opportunistic insofar as they're going to start defending the prerogatives of the national government or the prerogatives of the executive branch against protesting states. Federalism has never been an issue of pure argument. It has always been opportunistic. That is, the people making pro-federalism or anti-federalism claims have always been opportunistic in the sense of looking to federalism claims as ports in the storm against what they view as, at the very least, unwise national policy. So it's simply going to be business as usual, but with a lot of reversed polarities going on.
So given what you just said about the U.S. Supreme Court being so highly conservative and really arguing for state sovereignty and state rights, and they've done that largely, it seems, up until this point because they didn't like federal programs. They didn't like programs that maybe helped the poor. They didn't like Supreme Court decisions right, like Roe versus Wade or all of those types of things. And so now, given that it's still a very highly conservative states' rights Supreme Court, but now it's going to be the left that is going to say, we don't want to do mass deportations of immigrants. We do not want to start a registry of a particular religion. We don't want to do these things, and we are not going to enforce them. How would ideology come to play here? So we've got the ideology of states' rights and sovereignty of the states.
You know, frankly, we'll just have to wait and see. The most intriguing decision of the last half dozen years by far was the Obamacare decision, which had two aspects to it. One of them dealt with the so-called mandate, forcing people to buy insurance. And there the court notably split 5-4, and conservatives castigated Chief Justice Roberts for joining with the four moderates or four liberals to say that Congress had the power to require the purchase of insurance. There was a second part of that decision, the very same day, dealing with whether or not the national government could force states to expand their Medicaid programs at the risk of losing all federal financing, even for existing Medicaid programs. And there you had a 7-2 decision by the court in which you had the five conservatives plus Justices Kagan and Breyer, who all agreed that the national government was overreaching and being too coercive in trying to use its federal funding power to force the states to accept this national program without presenting sufficiently good reasons for forcing them to do this. Now, there were two dissents. Ruth Ginsburg wrote, you know, a very vigorous dissent saying that Congress had this power. But what's really, really interesting is that Kagan and Breyer said that Congress was overreaching. So we will find out in subsequent litigation. And if Breyer and Kagan continue to argue that there are limits on national power to force, in this case, liberal states to line up behind conservative programs, then it will be much harder to accuse them of being simply opportunistic or of being hypocritical. And then we'll have to wait and to see what the conservatives do. Now, from a strictly legal point of view, it is really, really interesting to contemplate some of the issues that are going to come up. If this were a different program, we could talk about litigation involving executive power in foreign affairs, and executive power to declare war, where, you know, there might be a lot of similar flips going on about the degree to which liberals are really so happy with executive power. But with regard to federalism, which we're talking about today, there is certainly opportunity for both the left and the right to be tested in terms of the nature of their commitments to national or state power.
The other part of that book that you mentioned, your new book that dealt with nullification, also deals with secession. And right. You mentioned in your introduction, of course, Texas had been threatening to secede from the Union. And we haven't really seen very much of that historically, other than the big one that caused the Civil War. What do people need to know about secession in this age?
Well, I mean, that's the... Again, really, really interesting question, certainly from the standpoint of pure theory, but also, obviously, should it ever really take off, it has deadly practical consequences. As I was driving around earlier today, the main story on BBC News was Brexit and the speech by Prime Minister May about a so-called hard Brexit, which is nothing more than Britain seceding in a very strong sense from the European Union. And then, of course, the very next question is, what about Scotland? Will Scotland secede from a 308-year-old United Kingdom and cast its lot with the EU? And the quick answer is, why not? So if you look around the world, you see that secessionism is alive and well, and not only as a theoretical proposition. If you look at the United States, you see that there are, in fact, secessionist movements all over the country, but they're not really serious politically. They're really treated as either jokes or as things that no serious politician has to think about. Well, I think that a really interesting question over the next 4 years is whether the half dozen or so secessionist movements in California become serious. I mean, it's kind of interesting, for lack of a better word, that Peter, I don't know how his last name is pronounced, Thiel or Tile, the Silicon Valley billionaire who stood out as the one Silicon Valley supporter of Donald Trump, and he contributed a lot of money to Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera, also is a supporter of secession. And there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley, the radical libertarians, who would be quite happy to secede and go their own way. You have other Californians who, at least in, you know, conversations at the bar, talk about secession. So what I've done is to speculate, and it's nothing more than speculation, what would it take for what I call Pacifica? That is California, Oregon, Washington, maybe Hawaii, maybe Nevada, to say quite seriously, you know, we can make a go of it on our own. California, I think, is the eighth largest economy in the world. Why does it really need the rest of the United States? There are answers to that question. But one of the things that Donald Trump is testing is whether or not what Lincoln called the mystic cords of memory really bind us together that much anymore. I have my law degree from Stanford, and one of the things I did when I spent 3 years living in California was to teach Sunday school at a Reform Jewish synagogue one year. And the most interesting lesson I learned in that experience is that for most Californians, American history begins in 1849, not in 1620, or not as for Mexican Americans in the 16th century with the conquest of Mexico. And, you know, do Californians as a group really have all that much identity with the rest of the country to say, well, let's stick it out, even if we're more and more horrified by what we're seeing? I simply don't know. I think one would bet against the creation of a truly significant California secessionist movement. But then, of course, you would have bet against Donald Trump becoming president, or you would have bet against the UK seceding from the European Union. So I think one of the things we ought to realize is that a lot of things that we took for granted are up for grabs. And who knows what the country or the world will look like in 2020 or 2025.
So, Sandy Levinson, suppose that secessionist movement did take hold. Constitutionally speaking, what would it require?
Well, the quick and dirty answer to that is that there is no constitutional right to secede. And as some of my colleagues in the law schools would say, that was decided in the famous case of Grant versus Lee, where Lee surrendered. And from one perspective, sure, that's right. But actually, let me go back to Colorado and marijuana, because from a strictly legal perspective, it's just an easy argument to make that Colorado has no constitutional right to believe that it can successfully legalize marijuana against conflicting federal law. But the national government backed down. It decided it wasn't worth paying the political costs. So the ultimate question would be, if in fact California or Pacifica said, we want out, what would the rest of the country do? One quick answer is it would send in the troops and arrest Jerry Brown or Gavin Newsom or whoever is governor for treason and try to throw him in jail. Another answer is to say, actually, what James Buchanan said in 1860, you know, you don't have a legal right to secede, but we can't really keep together a genuine union, which depends on affection by military force. And so what Buchanan said is that you don't have a legal right to do what you're doing, but we really can't stop you by sending in the troops. Lincoln, of course, had a very, very different response, and we had a war that killed 750,000 people. Now, you can say quite easily that that war was worth it in order to overcome slavery, but if you want to speculate, and that's all we're doing is speculating, what would the rest of the country say if California or Pacifica said, we want it out? Would the rest of the country say, this is absolutely outrageous, we're going to send in the troops and order them to fire not only our fellow citizens in some abstract sense, but on our relatives? Most people in this country probably have relatives who live in Pacifica, given that more than one-eighth of the country lives in California alone. You know, that's what any civil war inevitably raises. And what we see around the world are different responses. Czechoslovakia dissolved into the Czech Republic and Slovakia peacefully. Slovenia, in fact, seceded from Yugoslavia peacefully. In the rest of Yugoslavia, to put it mildly, it was not peaceful, and there was horrendous bloodshed. The Soviet Union dissolved peacefully. You had the secession, not only the bulk of the Baltic states, but of Ukraine, of Kazakhstan, and many of the other Soviet socialist republics without a shot being fired. These are all political questions in which lawyers, frankly, aren't very useful.
Rather, it's going to be the negotiators, it sounds like you're saying.
Well, I mean, depending on what the political realities are, it may be that what I'm describing will simply not come to pass because Californians will say, well, we really don't like Donald Trump. We really don't like what the national government is doing, but we're all part of the United States of America together. And these people, whether Peter Thiel or, you know, left wingers or whoever, are all just crazy, and we don't want to hear any talk of this. That, you know, would make this a complete non-starter. If, on the other hand, these arguments really take purchase, then who knows?
So, Sandy Levinson, last question for you. When you look at these really gargantuan gulfs between the agendas, would you say that we do have a historic reference for things being this divisive?
Well, unfortunately, the one genuine historical reference is the 1850s and 1860s, because political scientists have shown for years that Congress is now more polarized than it's been since the 1850s. There is no Republican in the House or the Senate, not a single one to the left of any Democrat in the House or the Senate. That also entails that there is no Democrat to the right of any Republican. If you look on the Supreme Court, you discover that the four justices appointed by Democrats, that is by Clinton and Obama, are all to the left, broadly speaking, of the four justices appointed by Republican presidents, even though it's true that on occasion Anthony Kennedy will join with the Democratic justices, or in the Obamacare decision, John Roberts joined with them to uphold the mandate. By and large, they don't join together, and you have a polarized Supreme Court. I think that psychologically, the United States at the current moment is in what could be described accurately as a pre-Civil War sort of mentality, in which an increasing number of Americans view their fellow citizens as enemies. And this is true whether you're talking about the Republicans who wanted to lock up Hillary Clinton, or Democrats like myself who view Donald Trump as a menace, and many of his supporters, not all, but many of his supporters, as exactly what Hillary Clinton described them as being, that is deplorable, and not really and truly being part of the same broad citizenry with whom we can have communion with and engage in genuinely respectful dialogue. Now, to be in this psychology doesn't guarantee that war is going to break out. You know, we could go in a variety of directions. But I think that there is a general polarization and bitterness in American politics that is unprecedented in my lifetime, and I'm 75. And I think if you look at American history generally, you really do have to go back to the 1850s and early 1860s.
Well, Sanford Levinson, it's always a joy to host you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I would say it's been my pleasure, except that what we're talking about really isn't very pleasant.
Sanford Levinson is professor of law and government at the University of Texas, the author or co-author of 10 books, including Our Undemocratic Constitution, and the latest, Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.